Welcome to the Eco News Report. My name is Tom Wheeler, the Executive Director of the Environmental Protection Information Center, better known in these parts as EPIC. Joining me as always is Larry Glass of the North Coast Environmental Center. Hey, Larry.
Howdy, Tom.
Scott Greeson of Friends of the Eel River.
Hey, Tom.
And Matthew Marshall, our special guest. What is your title?
Executive Director of the Redwood Coast Energy Authority.
There we go. So Matthew is our resident clean energy nerd, and he's going to come.
He's an authority on energy.
He is an authority on energy. He is the executive director, by golly. So he's going to educate us today about energy. Because I think that one thing that the TerraGen project has exposed is the degree to which our community just kind of doesn't get how we get energy here on the North Coast.
Well, that and the power outages.
I still don't understand what the heck has happened. And I imagine maybe you have a little bit better of a guess.
Yeah, no, I think the public safety power shutoff situation highlighted electricity as an important resource. And I think it kind of really brought home that this is something that when it goes away, you're like, oh, wait a minute, what's going on and why is it going on? And
yeah,
what can we do about
why
it?
Why can't we run our local power off our local power station?
So this also brings up this old Aldo Leopold thing that like people don't know where their food comes from. They think they get it from a grocery store, but they don't know where their heat comes from. They think it comes from the radiator. We don't really know where our power comes from. We just turn on a light and it works. So we take for granted our infrastructure and the hardworking men and women like yourself who work to make sure that light switch works every time we flick it. So just basically, let's start at the beginning. What is RCEA, the Redwood Coast Energy Authority? What is it you do? Why do you exist?
Yeah, so we're a joint powers agency of the county, all the incorporated cities in Humboldt County and the Humboldt Bay Municipal Water District. We've been around since 2003, and so we work on behalf of our member governments to implement sustainable energy initiatives, which means a range of things. You know, that includes energy efficiency and conservation programs, which is kind of what our bread and butter has been since 2003 when we started, but also working on transportation programs, energy planning, renewable energy work. And in 2017, we launched a community choice energy program, which basically gives us local control over the sources of electricity that are consumed here in Humboldt County. And so we still partner with PG&E, who still owns and operates the grid and the distribution system. They still do all the billing, but through RCEA, we're able to have local control over actually where that electricity is coming from and the price of the generation piece, which is about, you know, less than 40% or so of the total bill cost is the actual energy that you're consuming. And then the rest is covering the infrastructure costs and taxes and fees. And
wow, the other 60% is all extra other stuff.
So Matt, when you say community choice program gives us through RCEA local control of energy sources, that doesn't necessarily mean local energy sources.
No. And so that's one of the things that, you know, I think is, you know, where things start to get complicated,
right?
That there's the way the grid is managed in California is as a collective grid. So we don't have like our own little Humboldt County system where, you know, we're buying power from a particular power plant and it's being delivered just to our customers. That any load serving entity, whether that's a community choice program like RCEA, which is becoming the norm in California and certainly in PG&E's territory, the power goes into a collective grid that's managed at the state level, and then you take out power that your customers are using, and you're credited that through a state market system. So it's fairly transactionally complicated, and you know really the way that's structured is it's like sort of a giant like swimming pool of water, if you use the water analogy, and you don't have a special pipeline that goes from a power plant that you have a contract with to your customers. You pay power plants to put water into the big pool, and then you conversely pay for what you're, you know, and credited for what you take out of that, you know, on the customer side. And so there's a state entity called the California Independent System Operator that most people have never even heard of that actually manages that whole market and that process. Now, that's on sort of a state level energy market basis. And that was really set up to avoid, you know, market manipulation like happened in the energy crisis with Enron. After that, they said, okay, we need to have a way that sort of lets, you know, independent power producers and different load serving entities entities that serve customers, you know, interact, but in a way that somebody can't game the system.
Because so, Enron really did fleece California customers.
And so, you know, the community choice energy model really emerged out of that because it was sort of an attempt at full deregulation where you say, oh, you can just buy power from whoever. But the way the rules were set up for that, it let somebody kind of, you know, manipulate the price thresholds and say, oh, well, my power plant's out today. Sorry. And oh, by the way, this other one isn't out and it's really expensive though. So what a coincidence. And so the community choice rule basically said, well, we don't want to have this sort of fully commercial deregulated market like they have in Texas and some other places where it's really kind of just about who's got the lowest rates and retail competition. They wanted to have sort of the ability for local communities to have some local control and set their own priorities, but then to do that in aggregate. So the formal name is community choice aggregation. And so local governments on behalf of the customers in their jurisdictions can basically say, okay, on behalf of all these homes and businesses, we're going to go out and procure power. And that, you know, lets you get more competitive pricing and lets you, you know, open it up to not just big consumers that kind of are market savvy and have, you know, energy managers and procurement departments that can go, you know, so if you're a Walmart or a university system, they have, you know, people that can transact and make deals with energy providers to do that. But, you know, your average resident isn't like going to go play the market and figure out how to get the best deal for their power, but also to meet state environmental goals. And so it's a way that, you know, local communities collectively can have that kind of control.
When you talk about the grid, I think, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind when you say grid is a like nice pattern of squares. But of course, what we're talking about here is the system of electrical transmission lines. And I guess one of the things that came clear to me in the public safety power shutoffs was how sort of contingent and historical and limited that system is in some ways. We only have a few transmission lines in and out of the North Coast. And so our options are in some ways really constrained by what we've got out there.
Yeah. You know, there's two levels to the grid. As far as our electric infrastructure, there's the transmission level, which is the big lines that move power around the state, you know, and like the big metal poles that go across the Arcata bottoms, you know, that are higher voltage and transmit power longer distances. And then there's the distribution system, which is the smaller, you know, wooden poles typically that are moving it around from that big system from a substation to our individual homes and businesses. And so there's kind of those two layers. You know, if you were in a city, there's definitely like more of a grid for the distribution system. There's lines going everywhere to every business. And then there's these kind of big backbones. The maps of the grid are not unlike sort of watershed maps in a way, because you've got these bigger systems that go to the smaller ones and go to smaller ones. And so for Humboldt County, there's a couple main large transmission lines that come in and out of the county. They basically go over to the Cottonwood substation, which is south of Redding. And then those two lines kind of come west over to the coast. One sort of follows close to 299 and goes up by Weaverville. And the other one goes more along 36. And then they both connect sort of to the east, northeast of Eureka at the Humboldt substation. And so those are kind of our two big feeders that bring power in and out of the county potentially. And then the local power plants like the PG&E plant or the existing biomass plants feed into that transmission system. And then that transmission system drops down and then goes out to our individual homes and businesses.
So when critics of the Terrigen Wind Project say this wouldn't supply power to Humboldt County,
Yeah, that's not true. So it's a incorrect assumption. The project is connecting to the Bridgeville substation, which is on that sort of southern line that I mentioned that sort of goes along 36. And then there's actually a few different sort of spots that connect out of there. It's a little bit more grid-like. There's a line that kind of goes south and one that goes north that are smaller than the main trunk line. You know, the power would go onto the grid there. Now, technically, it could go many different directions from that point. In general, Humboldt County is an importer of electricity. So we have some local generation at the PG&E plant, which uses natural gas to generate electricity. That's the biggest power plant. We've got a couple, you know, smaller biomass plants that use mill waste to generate electricity, one in Fairhaven, the one in Scotia. And then we have customer solar, you know, that's producing energy on people's homes. That's, you know, behind the meter. So that, you know, that's not really a grid resource. I mean, it contributes power, but it's, you know, before it kind of gets into the market, so to speak. Overall, though, with those, you know, resources, we're generally moving, we're bringing more power in to meet our needs. We're an importer, not an exporter of electricity. That's coming along those lines. And so in general terms, the Terrigen project connecting at Bridgeville would be offsetting imports when it's generating and or also offsetting the natural gas plant, which, again, the way that the California market works, renewables have first priority and they've been in at lower prices because the wind is free, whereas natural gas is not. And so generally, you know, when you see what resources kind of get first in sort of the daily stack of saying, okay, we need this much power to keep the lights on, you'll have renewables first, and then you'll have, you know, fossil fuel resources backfill that. And so whenever this project would be generating, it would be offsetting either those imports or the natural gas plant.
So we'll use that first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we necessarily know we can't specifically trace an electron from the wind project to your house, but there's also this idea that, you know, we're an importer, so it's going to stay in the county from a practical perspective.
I mean, Bridgeville is in Humboldt County, right? It's
still right. Yeah.
It's, you know, it's getting out towards Trinity County, but
right. Yeah, right.
Going the wrong direction, but you know,
but again, that's, you know, once it gets onto the grid, it can go either direction, right. And it's right. You know, that point, I can't say exactly why they chose that interconnection point, but you can flow power west to Eureka from there. If you have more than can flow on that line, it could also go at the same time east to the main stem, and it can also go north and south from that substation down towards Garberville and north. So, you know, there's a lot of directions that it can go. So that if you're producing at max output, you know, that power flow could go different directions, although I think 3 out of 4 of those directions are into Humboldt County.
So it flows by draw. So they're electrified, and then whoever's pulling it, that's where it's
going. Yeah, you know, it's again like putting water into a pipe system that, you know, wherever somebody turns on a faucet and there's water being pulled out, it's going to go in that path. And so TerraGen isn't going to be able to say, I want the electrons to take a left turn and head to Eureka. That's going to be the California Independent System Operator, based off of if they say, hey, you know, if there's extreme power shortages, let's say in the Central Valley, because everyone's turning on their air conditioners, they might say TerraGen's going to be running, but we also want the Humboldt Bay power plant to run at the same time so that power flows that way to alleviate constraints in the broader state. We're not like most communities in California in that we are sort of an isolated area where there is just kind of those couple in and out lines. You know, if you're in the Bay Area or Sacramento, you know, there's lines going every which direction. And so you really are more part of a grid that's, you know, very interconnected. We're kind of on this peninsula of the grid that, you know, has more of an in out structure to it. And that's where, you know, we can look at, you know, those power flows. And that's ultimately decided by the state based off of state priorities. But, you know, under most circumstances, natural gas is going to be a more expensive resource than renewables. And so the TerraGen project or any local renewable generation projects would kind of have first priority because they would say, well, wind is free, sun is free. And so that's going to go onto the grid first.
So now we kind of have a better understanding of how the grid works, right? So it's this self-equalizing thing, you know, power goes where it's needed. And Humboldt County is somewhat more unique in that we are more import-export. And right now we are a net importer. And so the more energy we can produce locally, we're going to keep more of those electrons here, relatively speaking.
Yeah, you know, and I think one thing that really kind of relates to RCA plans is looking at the broader need for energy in the community, not just electricity. And so, you know, we have a goal of getting to 100% non-fossil, non-nuclear energy sources by 2025, which is basically the state has set a similar goal, though they include nuclear technically in sort of zero carbon resources, but we're not including that ourselves as an objective.
You're not going to restart the nuke plant?
That's not a goal, no, although it's thankfully almost done with the decommissioning process. So it's been many years in the making.
I know Larry's going to be really disappointed.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as we're looking, you know, the state has set a goal of 2045 to get to, you know, renewable zero carbon sources by 2045. We're trying to accelerate that here in Humboldt by about 20 years. And then we're also interested in by 2030, if we can get as close as possible of having our needs met by local renewable resources so that we're actually meeting our own needs. And, you know, potentially being, you know, no longer a net importer, ideally maybe a net exporter. And I think there's a balance of saying, well, let's, you know, focus on meeting our own needs and not exploiting our resources for external purposes. But conversely, you know, we're all on the planet together, and the people of San Francisco and Oakland and Richmond and, you know, Los Angeles don't necessarily have the land and resource base to generate their own electricity. And to say, well, tough luck, let's just let them use fossil fuels is not good for the planet. And conversely, I don't want them to move to Hubble County because we've got abundant resources. You know, I'd rather us export some of our electricity if we're able to do that and generate renewables here. But, you know, even beyond being an exporter, I think if we're really looking at not being a net importer, we have to look at the other forms of energy we use, which are primarily natural gas for heating our homes and cooking and industrial processes. And then the big one, the elephant in the room, is transportation and our use of fossil fuels for transportation. And so really the key solutions for those are obviously reducing how much we need. So using less, being more efficient, riding your bike, riding public transportation, walking more. And so, you know, those are obviously the fundamental key strategies and the most cost effective. But also for the transportation and heating needs we do still have, you know, we're still going to take showers and need to heat our homes. You know, switching those sources to renewable electricity and electrifying through high efficiency air source heat pumps for building needs and electric vehicles. Those kinds of solutions can really dramatically reduce greenhouse gas emissions, especially when combined with efficiency and reductions in consumption. But then that means we're going to need actually more renewable electricity to meet those needs. And so, you know, it's not just about saying, well, let's stop getting our electricity from natural gas and fossil sources, which is great. But we also need to have the renewable generation capacity to start moving our transportation needs, which, you know, transportation is by far our biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions for Humboldt County. It's like more than half, you know, and natural gas is a huge chunk as well. And the electricity one is actually kind of the easiest to switch over because there's readily available technologies and it's a more centralized, you know, approach. You know, trying to get every single water heater and furnace and gas stove switched over in the county is going to be a very big undertaking in the next, you know, decade to really engage in that. And so overall, it's going to be a pretty epic endeavor, you know, not just for Humboldt County, but for civilization, really. I mean, we've just gotten so used to having energy dense fossil fuels that, you know, we can dig out of the ground and are easy to access and easy to burn. And
Matthew Marshall from the Redwood Coast Energy Authority is here, and we're talking about our energy grid system here in Humboldt County.
So those are aggressive goals. I think we can all agree they're hopeful. But where do we stand right now in terms of our energy mix? What's our current situation?
Yeah, so on the electric vehicle adoption rate, I'm going to go backwards towards electricity, is accelerating pretty rapidly. And part of that's because electric cars are just better than conventional vehicles. They're, you know, not just more efficient, but they're more fun to drive and they've got better acceleration and torque.
Fewer moving parts, right?
But yeah, there's less a lot less that can go wrong with an electric car. And so I think, you know, if you haven't test driven an electric vehicle, I would recommend it. But we're a long way from that being, you know, the majority of our vehicles. You know, I think we've passed the 1,000 vehicles on the road in Humboldt County, and we need to continue to accelerate that. On the natural gas side, that's probably the trickiest one because it is sort of, electric cars are fun to drive. So if you're looking at a gas vehicle, an electric vehicle, it's actually not such a hard sell. And they're also less expensive to drive by a good margin. So there's that advantage. People's water heaters are not as excited about. I think people have an attachment to cooking on gas, which is probably because they have their memories of the little spiral metal coil electric stoves that was in the dorm room or whatever, that's like garbage to cook on. But, you know, modern electric stove, you know, induction cooking is like, you know, a lot of top chefs are going to induction cooking, but even just modern electric stoves that are like the glass smooth top ones are actually give you, you know, better control and a good cooking experience. So people should try that out too. You know, our electric mix is moving in the right direction, probably the fastest in the sense that, you know, there's state mandates. And then as far as Redwood Coast Energy Authority, we're exceeding those state requirements pretty significantly for percentage of renewables and moving off of fossil fuels. And that's a trend across the state. So we still have a long way to go, though. And one of the things that we're really, again, focused on is kind of how do we meet our goals, you know, with long-term contracts that are getting new generation built. Because, you know, we launched in 2017 and we couldn't have something that was brand new in 2017 because we hadn't started yet. So, you know, there's a ramp up. And so we started with contracts with existing facilities. You know, locally we have two contracts with the two local biomass plants that are here in Humboldt. And we're building a 2-megawatt solar project in McKinleyville that'll have battery storage and also emergency response capabilities. And then we issued a request for qualifications for new renewables to meet our state requirements and our own goals. We had a preference for local projects, but it was open to, and then we had sort of a second tier for like regional projects, and then anything in the state was technically eligible. mostly, we got a lot of responses. We only had one response that was actually within Humboldt County, which was the TerraGen project. We had a few from kind of our two county region, and we've actually entered into a power purchase agreement with a small run of river hydroelectric project that's sort of east of Reading. It was an existing facility, and you know, it has a partial diversion of flow that goes through a powerhouse and then goes back into.
Is this the Pitt River?
Yes, I think so. It's over that direction. I'm trying to remember which like tributaries it's on. A group of our staff went and took a tour, but I didn't get to go on it. Okay. So it's not quite as firm in my mind of which exact riverway it's on. And there, you know, and so it's a small facility, and you know, there's not a dam associated with it. It's just again run of river. You know, and then we got a lot of responses for big solar projects down south in like the Fresno area, southern part of the Central Valley, and we're negotiating with a company for a project down there that would be like 50 megawatts of solar down kind of south of like Bakersfield, which again, that's going to benefit the broader grid. That's not going to directly cause there to be more local generation and local reliability. And so, you know, the price is right for that. And it's good from sort of a you know, market standpoint. But what we really want to do is focus on local generation projects that kind of have benefits beyond just kind of the bigger grid, but really benefits to Humboldt County.
So this is a way that we'll get to 100% by 2025. There's also a mechanism for individuals in the county to beat that 2025 deadline and get to 100% renewable power by themselves. Can you talk about Repower Plus?
Yeah, so we have, you know, what you could say is a product or an option where folks can basically opt up and pay a penny a kilowatt hour more, which is kind of like a cup of coffee a month or so price for a typical household. And that basically goes to 100% power as soon as you sign up, you know, and then we manage our portfolio of power. Again, you know, there's not like separate power lines that go to your home if you sign up for that. It's what we're buying and having put into the grid on your behalf. And so that's something that's available now. Actually, the city of Blue Lake opted up all of their city accounts, so the wastewater treatment plant, City Hall, and City of Arcata has done the same, and a number of local businesses have done the same. And so that's something that people can do if you don't want to wait till 2025 when we hopefully get there for the whole county. And then that just provides that little kicker that covers the incremental cost of buying more wind, more solar to cover a customer's energy usage.
All right. Well, as a Eurekan, I know now what I need to bother my city council about. Get the city to sign up.
I know they did some analysis of looking at city accounts, and you know, it's a cup of coffee for a home. If you've got wastewater treatment plans and stuff, it's a lot more than a cup of coffee. And so, you know, there is a reason why it's not the norm and why it's not just what every customer has already, because there is an incremental cost there, although that the gap is narrowing between fossil fuels and renewables. So it's getting more and more affordable. The one other thing I was going to say is if people are interested in contributing to, you know, and doing their part, we have it's called Net Energy Metering Program that's aligns with PG&E's program that's been around for quite some time, where if you put solar on your home or your business, you get a credit. We actually provide a kicker. So we give like a bonus penny kilowatt hour for people that overgenerate. And so we actually cut checks if people want to cash out their overgeneration at the end of the year. You know, every May, we will say, okay, these people have a credit. We'll let them know if they want to cash it out. We'll send them a check. You know, I think, you know, we have several hundred customers that, you know, are in that realm of generating more than they use. And then we have what's called a feed-in tariff, which is kind of a clunky, nerdy term, but it basically is for small sort of community scale generation projects that are designed to put power primarily onto the grid, as opposed to the net metering program, which is primarily for your on-site load. So, you know, if you've got a business and you're overgenerating a little bit, you can do that through the NEM program, the Net Energy Metering Program. But if you say, hey, I've just got, you know, a big barn roof or something, and I really don't use any energy, but I want to put a bunch of solar on that, or I've got a big, you know, piece of property and I want to put solar in this corner, but it's way bigger than what my on-site energy needs are. We have a sort of standardized contract mechanism that we launched just last April, where people can basically say, hey, here's an application. I want to do a project. The pricing is standardized, so they know what that is. They can take it to the bank. And we're seeing a lot of interest. I think we just got our first application for that project. That program for a project down in Southern Humboldt. And so that's something that if people have land or a property where they think they could have a site for that, and there's a lot of, you know, solar developers that do those kinds of projects.
So basically a small commercial operation.
Yeah. You know, and so this is like, if you've been out to the Blue Lake Ranch area,
just going to mention that,
you know, their solar array is like half a megawatt for scale. So that's, if you see that, that's like 500 kilowatts or half a megawatt. And so, you know, this project is up to basically twice that size. So it's like for a megawatt or less, so, you know, as small as you want, but, you know, somewhere in that kind of a ballpark. So pretty big system. It could be smaller than that. It could be bigger than that, but in that range.
So in a recent show, we had Nancy Stevenson from RCAA and Stephen Coleman from the Blue Lake Rancheria's Natural Resources Division in talking about electric vehicles and about microgrids. And talked especially about the Blue Lake Rancheria's microgrid. And basically, they defined a microgrid as anything on the other side of the meter, basically. So you can disconnect that chunk of demand and supply from the grid and have it run independently. Would you talk about the role of microgrids in moving toward a more resilient power system for Humboldt?
Yeah, I think it's sort of an exciting realm that's really developing quickly. And things like the public safety power shutoff, I think, got a lot of interest in that. Of like, hey, right. Wait a minute, tell me about these microgrids again. What about
Planning solar? You know, because I noticed the hospital was on.
If you do just solar, that doesn't actually, it's not set up to configured to run your house. You know, when the power goes out, you need to pair that with batteries and other elements. And so I'll also make the distinction, if you could have a renewable energy backup system that's solar and storage and it'll power your house. That's not really a microgrid. That's just a renewable generator that's running your house, you know, and that's still a cool thing to do. You know, microgrid is more when you have multiple buildings and then an actual, like, you know, and potentially multiple generation sources or storage, and you're having to coordinate all those things working together, right. Which is where it starts to get more complicated.
Stephen talked about this as sort of the controller being the heart of the microgrid.
Yeah, because, you know, there's elements of making sure that, you know, you're not frying your computer and the, you know, let's say you've got, you know, multiple solar arrays. Well, okay, how are you balancing those out? And then having the storage, you know, ramp up when it needs to, and you know, that whole control element of
which points to the fact that these things aren't free. They cost more than regular grid connections.
Yeah, so it's not a low cost option. I think it's when you kind of start to layer in additional, you know, benefits. I mean, so if you buy a backup generator that runs off of gas or diesel, it's going to be cheaper. You can do that and see the stacks of them in every hardware store at the moment. That's going to beat just on a price basis for your emergency needs. The difference being, you know, one, that gas generator doesn't do anything good for you the rest of the year when you don't need it, whereas solar and storage actually can provide economic as well as environmental benefits the other 360 days of the year when it's not a power outage. You know, and then the other thing is, you know, as we saw with the recent outages, that fuel can become a scarce commodity. And that was in a quasi-planned disaster. If it was a real disaster and you're having to make the choice of, well, do we send gasoline to this grocery store's generator? Or do we send it to the sheriff's department or the fire department, you know, to the water treatment facility, the hospital, yeah. You know? Yeah. And so having a resilient renewable system that can supplement or offset the need for liquid fuels that then can go to other uses, especially if there was, you know, an extended outage and an emergency situation, that could be important. And so a project it's going to happen at some point. How big, how bad, right. We don't know.
Right.
So we're working on a project in partnership with the folks at Humboldt State University at the Schatz Energy Research Center to do a microgrid at the county airport. It's fairly new. It's kind of like the next evolution of the system that Blue Lake has.
So that's going to be the airport, the Coast Guard station, and the dog pound.
Yes.
The vital services.
And the gun club, actually. They're sort of the happy, they're just on the little end of there. I think they've got, you know, a couple lights or something, but they happen to be on this branch of the grid.
Right.
And that's what's kind of unique about it. You know, if you want to say a typical microgrid is usually a single kind of customer that has their own sort of campus and their own personal grid. So, you know, the Blue Lake Rancheria, you know, purchase the localized grid in their area to basically be able to isolate themselves. And so you'll see them, you know, microgrids at universities, tribal facilities, military bases, things like that, where you can have this single customer that can do their own thing. And so this project in partnership with PG&E and the county is going to be multiple customers on one branch of actually PG&E's distribution grid. And so instead of having like a little private grid, RCA will own and operate the solar and storage, which will be about five times bigger than the Blue Lake Rancheria system. So it'll be quite large solar and battery storage system that when it's a normal day, we'll just operate that to provide power to our customers, and we'll operate the battery to provide economic and grid benefits under normal circumstances. But if there's an outage, we'll be able to have the control system and the configuration to work with PG&E basically to island that little branch of the grid that includes the airport, the runway lights, the Coast Guard, the animal shelter, and a few other accounts that happen to be next to those facilities that are of importance. And so, you know, that's kind of like what people are talking about of being able to run the PG&E plant to power our whole county. This is sort of a localized version of that. And because the solar and storage are like wholesale sized, you know, kind of bigger community type generation sources, you know, they're oversized to the airport and Coast Guard load. So we'll basically be able to run the airport and the Coast Guard indefinitely off of solar and storage, even if it's in the middle of the winter. And then they'll still have their generator backups if, you know, for whatever reason, it's a really dark period and, you know, the system can't keep up with their loads. They'll still have their existing generators as a backup, but instead of having to use fuel to run generators, they'll be able to run off of the sun pretty much indefinitely, you know, while the system's, nice. If it's up and running.
This is too easy, Matthew.
Yeah. All we did was press play.
I'll add, you know, one more thought about just kind of the, you know, the microgrids and the resiliency thing. I think that's something that really has kind of been elevated of like, well, we want to switch to renewables and we need to do that for climate change mitigation and to get ourselves off of fossil fuels. We want to do that in a way that's affordable for everybody, because I think what we don't want to do is to say, oh, well, let's just have rich people build their microgrids and have their Teslas and let's leave the rest of the community behind. And, you know, so what we don't want to see is like where you start to have, oh, there's these gated communities that have their microgrid and, you know, the folks in the trailer park are out of luck, or the people in the rural communities are out of luck. And so, you know, I think we need to do it in a way that's equitable to everybody. And that means that it's going to be affordable and accessible. And I think we need to do it in a way that enhances resiliency and doesn't detract from that, you know, and really the convenience of fossil fuels and being able to just say, oh, sure, we've got gasoline, we've got coal, we've got natural gas. These things are easy to use. And sure, it took millions of years to make them, but now we can just have this very convenient, easy to use energy to switch off of that and to switch to harnessing the sun and the wind in current natural environment in a sustainable way that isn't depleting our resources. That's a challenge to make that switch. That's where we need to acknowledge that people have to make a living, and we want to do that in a way that doesn't just even benefit California, but it's like, what about the rest of the country? What about the rest of the world? Creating a world where we have all the awesome benefits of electricity. I mean, electricity is great. It's like having access to transportation is like great. It's like whenever you don't have it, you're like, oh, my life just got a lot harder and a lot more challenging. And so creating a world that isn't miserable, but is actually a resilient and prosperous world, you know, not just for wealthy people, but for everybody, is going to be a technical challenge. And we're really going to need to throw every tool in the tool shed at the problem, because creating the issue of climate change was pretty easy because we could just use fossil fuels. And then you're saying, okay, well, now we've got this lifestyle that's great and convenient. How do we switch that to one that's great and convenient, but doesn't consume so much and is using the current planet's resources in a responsible, efficient way? And that's going to be a much harder thing to do than the transition through the Industrial Revolution just to get us to where we are today. But I think it seems like while it's hard, it's doable, and we just need to roll up our sleeves and not give up.
It's harder, but we also have less time. So
yeah, you know, so it's well.
All right. Well, thank you, Matthew. If people want to find out how to get on Repower Plus or find out more information about RCEA, where should they go?
Yeah, they can go to our website, which is redwoodenergy.org, or they can give our office a call at 269-1700, or they can even just stop by. We're in Old Town, kind of right behind the Lost Coast Brewery.
It's in the building with the cute elk mural on the back.
Yes, there is a mural on the back, thanks to the Eureka Street Art Festival.
There we go. All right. Well, thank you, Matthew. This has been the Eco News Report. Join us again next week at this time and channel for more local environmental news.